Good morning. The first case we have this morning is United States versus Swift. Are the parties ready? Okay, we'll hear from the appellant.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, my name is Captain Michael Gold, and I, along with Major Andres Vasquez, represent the appellant, Specialist Swift. I respectfully request to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
That's granted.
May it please the court. This case is about the details. The details show that it is not a case about different versions of events, but it is a case about different events altogether. Specification 1 occurs in Hawaii. Appellant's statement talks about an incident in a bed. KS testified about an incident in a van. Specification 2 occurs in Texas. Appellant's statement talks about an incident while alone with KS in her bed after reading a story. KS testified about an incident after pushing her sister in a pool and another incident where she was already asleep next to her mother while lying in her parents' bed. As a starting point, this court and the Army Court cannot affirm appellant's conviction based on a theory that was not presented to the trier of fact. The government theory was that appellant was charged with his admissions to Special Agent JS, and that these two admissions were separate instances of misconduct from the three that KS described. It is through that lens of this theory presented at trial that this court has to evaluate each of the granted and specified issues.
Now, is this a problem at the court-martial, or is this a problem at the CCA?
This is a problem at the CCA, Your Honor. This is a problem in that the appellant was convicted based off of his sworn statements. The government made clear that its evidence at trial and theory at trial of the case was that appellant admitted to everything that is on the charge sheet, and that is something the defense can't get around. That's a JA-208, JA-209. And while the accused only admits to assaulting KS twice, you heard her testimony that in addition to those two times, there are three others that she remembers.
Let's say that we agree with you that a bed is not a van and a bed is not a pool, right? Is there a reason that we couldn't send this back to the CCA and that they couldn't just conduct a proper 66 review?
They could conduct a proper 66 review underneath that. However, that's not a jurisdictional issue in terms of whether or not this court should address the other issues that are present in this case, Your Honor. As was noted in McAllister, Your Honor, the court decided that it didn't need to decide whether the factual sufficiency determination by the court below was defective in light of its decisions regarding the other issues in the case.
Well, you seem concerned with the corroboration point, right, with respect to his admissions?
Yes, Your Honor.
What is your view about the fact that the other information, like, was offered at least in part to show propensity?
In terms of propensity, Your Honor, going towards the convictions for the corroboration of the statement, Your Honor, the propensity evidence, A, there's no ruling by the military judge on 404B or 414 in this particular case. While the government went to great lengths, Your Honor, to note that the 404B evidence was incumbent for the defense to object to a trial, so too is it incumbent, if the government wants to use propensity, to actually get a ruling from the military judge. The right test requires that the military judge actually put a ruling on the record and admit the evidence for propensity purposes. With respect to the propensity and what it was offered for, it actually wasn't offered to corroborate the statement at all. It was offered to negate the statement itself, not corroborate.
Well, isn't the issue of corroboration waived?
Your Honor, in terms of the issue of waiver, the corroboration was actually forfeited. This court doesn't need to look any further than its own precedent as cited by the government.
They didn't object to its admission. That's a waiver.
In terms of that, Your Honor, this court has previously held that in United States versus Arnold, the granted issue there was whether the military judge plainly erred by admitting appellant's confession based on testimony derived exclusively from the confession itself, which failed to satisfy the independence requirement of the corroboration rule. There was no objection at trial, in that particular case, and that was done in 2005, and this court granted a plain error analysis of forfeiture.
Counsel, don't you think, regardless of whether the military judge made a ruling with respect to the other incidents of sexual misconduct or not, that you have rather an uphill battle to show that, to say that there was no corroboration of his confession when there was testimony by the victim about similar types of acts on other occasions?
And I think with respect to that, Your Honor, this court's decision in United States versus Rounds is instructive. This court looked at Rounds' admissions to using cocaine on two separate occasions, the first at a party on Thanksgiving and the second at a party on New Year's Eve. The court looked at the testimony provided by Airman Sachs regarding each event separately. It did not use the independent evidence from the Thanksgiving party to the admissions of the New Year's Eve party or vice versa. The court looked
at counsel, here the defense was this was a mistake. Right? It was an accident. I didn't mean to touch my daughter's vagina. Right? It was an accident. I was dreaming. I thought it was my wife.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you don't think that her testimony that he did these things intentionally on three other occasions, A, corroborates that he touched her, and B, is pretty good evidence that it wasn't a mistake?
In terms of the specific instances, United States versus Adams shows that we have to look at the essential facts of each of the crimes. When you look at the specific facts, Your Honor, they don't match up. And that goes back.
If corroboration required that the evidence exactly matched up, it wouldn't just be corroboration. It would be a slam dunk proof, right? The law doesn't require that.
Yes, Your Honor, but if you look at what the basis of the rule is in terms of trustworthiness, this case is the perfect example of what it is meant to prevent. The Supreme Court in United States versus Opper and Smith understood that an accused is under intense pressure when he comes in under investigation and could potentially make something up, a complete fabrication. Well, in this particular instance, we know that on the 5th of September, 2007, the accused was brought into CID. At JA 228, we know that he sees the allegations written down. On his DA 3881, he notes that he came in yesterday and had counsel and was shown the allegations. So he knows what these allegations are.
Counsel, I'd like to roll back just a minute to Judge Stuckey's question because I am a little confused about why this isn't waiver. And I noted that in the record, when the confession was about to be admitted, before the defense counsel was even asked by the military judge, he jumped up and said, no objection, right? I haven't been in the courtroom in an age, I admit. But I thought that's how you waive stuff.
Well, to a certain extent, you can't tell in terms of timing, Your Honor. But yes, the military judge did not ask the question to begin with. But at the same
time. But he didn't have to ask the question, does he? Does he have to ask the question?
No, Your Honor.
The defense counsel jumps up and says, no objection?
He does not. But as noted in Girard, we look at the type of right that's at issue here. And while not constitutional in nature, the corroboration rule is a tenet of American jurisprudence as recognized by the Supreme Court that has a long history of judicial experience with confession.
Right, but isn't the reason why you should object so that you can hash it all out before the military judge? Isn't that the whole purpose of having an objection rule or a waiver rule? In other words, why would you seek to have an issue like this tried on appeal? When the judge had everything there, had everybody there, if he needed witnesses, he could have called the witnesses in. They could have resolved the issue there. So why shouldn't counsel be deemed to have waived?
Certainly, Your Honor, but there's the distinction between forfeiture as being the failure to make a timely assertion.
Forfeiture, I always thought, was when you sit on your hands and don't say anything. This is an affirmative, I have no objection.
Is your point that the fact that he didn't object to the admission of his admission doesn't mean that we don't have to find independent corroboration of the confession?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right, because I mean that seems to be what the rule says.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right, but it certainly has something to do with the plain error standard. it seems to me.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, Judge Ryan and I may disagree.
And in terms of the plain error standard, it's also useful to look at the plain language of the rule. 304C5 does note that the military judge alone is to determine when adequate evidence of corroboration has been received under Part 5 of the procedure.
All right.
With respect to the Thanksgiving party in Rounds, Your Honor, this court found that even though there was direct evidence of Round being present, in the presence of known drug users on that specific occasion, it was insufficient to corroborate the essential facts of access to drugs on that particular occasion. General access and opportunity were not enough. Here,
that's a lot different than what we're looking at here, right? We're looking here at the victim testifying to the exact same sorts of acts by the exact same person on three different occasions.
And, Your Honor, if I were to say that I robbed a Wells Fargo bank 2 days ago in September, and the police were to come at me and charge me with a crime of having robbed a BNT in a different state during the same month, those two wouldn't corroborate each other. The specific instances themselves have to match up to at least some degree. Additionally, Adams held that there was where their only direct evidence of the crime was the confession, it's important to determine what was not corroborated. Here, it's those exact specific facts that are not corroborated. There's nothing to corroborate the specific time, place of the charged Hawaii bedside incident, or the charged Texas Old Flame incident. That goes towards looking at the record as a whole when we look at whether or not it was plain. It's clear from the evidence presented at trial, based off of the government's argument that these were five separate events, that those different events don't corroborate each other. In fact, that's exactly what the government argued at trial, them being separate and distinct events. In terms of the material prejudice prong, Your Honor, in Adams, the admission of the uncorroborated essential facts was prejudicial to Adams because the confession was the government's key piece of evidence. Here, the confession is the government's only piece of evidence, and it similarly prejudiced appellant. Second, without appellant's sworn statement, the evidence of the two convictions of indecent acts with a child is legally insufficient. The only evidence the government presented of the charged acts was appellant's sworn statement. Without this evidence, you're left with KS's testimony regarding three other acts. General accusations by KS made to various individuals that necessarily relate back to her version of events, and testimony from the two experts who have and provide no personal knowledge of the actual crimes. United States versus Chiarella precludes this court and the Army Court from affirming specification 2 based on the evidence of the uncharged Texas bedside incident, as it was not a theory presented to the trier of fact. To the extent that the indecent acts are legally insufficient even with the appellant's statement, we rely on our brief. Lastly, at the very least, this court should send the case back to the Army Court because the details of the Army's opinion show that they affirm the findings and the sentence based on the uncharged misconduct rather than the charged offenses. Subject to the court's questions, I respectfully request to reserve the remainder of my time.
Okay, we'll hear from you on rebuttal. We'll now hear from the government.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Sam Landis, and along with Captain Carling Dunham, I represent the United States. This court should affirm the CCA for three reasons. First, the offenses that the appellant talked about in his sworn statement and the testimony of the victim match what the offenses on the charge sheet. Second, appellant waived any objection to the admission of his sworn statement and cannot show plain error. And
counsel,
third,
I noticed that in your brief you didn't really get into waiver. Why was that?
Your Honor, in the brief we focused on forfeiture, but the plain language of MRE 304, what the President wrote when he wrote 304 and explained the circumstances for the admission of a confession, is that the issue is waived, and it cannot be raised later unless the military judge allows it for good cause shown. So we now, looking at that plain language of the rule, believe that this was an issue that was waived at trial. And third and finally, appellant's sworn statement is a part of this court's legal sufficiency review. Turning first to the CCA's review in this case, one issue is easily dealt with, and that is the 2007 Indecent Act in Texas. The appellant said it happened in his house in Texas in 2007 in his sworn statement. The victim testified that it happened in their house in Texas in 2007. Minor discrepancies in the proof do not make these separate and distinct incidents. Turning then to the 2003 Indecent Act, what's important here is comparing what's on the charge sheet with what evidence there is in the record of the trial.
No, counsel, you don't get to do that, okay? I mean, I'm sorry, but you don't get to come up here and recreate your charge based on the evidence that was used not to prove the charge defenses, which you said at trial were what he confessed to, but to the other stuff that she testified about, which was not charged. I mean, that was very clear at trial.
Your Honor, respectfully, it's less clear.
So you could have had a variance if you were doing it at the trial level, right? But now you're stuck with the theory that you used at trial. The CCA doesn't get to affirm on a different theory, and we certainly don't get to.
Yes, Your Honor, the theory of the case, as described by cases like United States versus Dunn, cases like United States versus Riley, is not so much the factual theory that the trial counsel suggests in argument, for instance, about the circumstances of the offense, whether it was daytime or nighttime, something like that. It's in Riley and Dunn, it was instructed to the jury or to the panel. The jury in Dunn was instructed, you must consider these two sworn statements. The Court of Appeals affirmed on a third sworn statement. In Riley, it was instructed to the panel, you may not consider the accused's failure to seek medical help. And the Court of Appeals affirmed on the accused's failure to seek medical help. So what we have here is the trial counsel's sort of advocacy theory about the details of the offense.
Well, what was the theory? What was the government's theory at trial?
The government's theory at trial was confused. It was inconsistent. It was not as clear as appellant suggests. Certainly, there's a pretrial motion in which it lays out what
But he clearly said during one of his arguments, one of the incidents of clarity in this entire trial, when he said that the defendant admitted, it's his own statements, he admitted to the charges on the charge sheet. Okay, go from there.
Yes, Your Honor. The reason it's not clear is because standing next to that statement in the joint appendix is this on joint appendix at 15. This comes during the opening statement, the trial counsel's opening statement. But most importantly, you're going to hear from the accused himself through his sworn statement about one of these incidents, which would suggest that the 2007 offense is the one that he's focusing on for purposes of the sworn statement, and that the incident in the van, the sexual assault in the van, that the victim testifies about. So at a minimum, the appellant can't show what the theory is because it's inconsistent in the record.
I'm surprised that you're making this argument instead of just saying, you're right, the CCA clearly got it wrong, send it back and let him do it over.
Certainly that would be the remedy, Your Honor. That would be the remedy if the CCA relied on a theory in the due process sense provided by Dunn, N. Riley, Chiarella, cases like that, the remedy would be to just send it back.
Well, you say that, he says that, why are we here?
Because the government certainly does not confess error, assuming for the sake of argument.
Well, you just said the remedy would be to kick it back.
I mean, don't you think it would be better to just confess that it's error than to make this kind of silly argument that's directly contradicted by the record of trial and what happened at the trial?
When you make silly arguments, sometimes you get silly law.
I agree, Your Honor. I agree. We respectfully believe that the record is inconsistent on what the theory is, and for that reason this court could affirm the CCA, but recognize also that if this court were to disagree with that, the remedy would be to remand back to the CCA.
But your approach seems to say if trial counsel makes a hash of things at a court-martial, the government benefits on appeal.
Not always, Your Honor. For instance,
but isn't that what you're arguing right here?
In this case, that may be the case.
So that's what you want this court's opinion to stand for, the proposition that when you're handling a court-martial, government, make a hash of things because then your conviction can stand on appeal.
There's an alternate message that an opinion like that with Sin, and that is that the defense should litigate these things at trial, litigate these things at the CCA.
So the burden is on defense here and not on the government?
How is the appellant supposed to know if the time it was at the CCA that they were going to write the opinion that they wrote? How could they foresee that?
Certainly they could not, Your Honor.
It seems to be a Chiarella sort of case, right?
What they could do is move to vacate the opinion or move for reconsideration and thus resolve that at the CCA level before coming here. What the appellant did here was to simply petition for this court's review Your Honor, certainly it was not unreasonable for them to petition this court. My point is only that they could have tried to resolve it at the CCA before. Turning then to the admission of the appellant's sworn statement in this case.
Before we do that, though, I'm not going to characterize your your argument in one way or the other, because I know you get the case, you got to argue the case you got. But can you tell me again why your case or this case is like or is not like Riley? I didn't follow the argument there.
Yes, Your Honor.
I know Riley there were several iterations of it, but the last iteration.
Yes, Your Honor. In Riley, the appellant gave birth to a baby, and that baby died. There were homicide charges brought, and at trial, at issue was whether the appellant meant to hurt the baby or whether the appellant allowed the baby to die through negligence, through failing to get help. The military judge, the prosecution explicitly disclaimed the second theory, that it was about the failure to get help. And when the prosecution did that, the military judge specifically instructed the panel members, you may not consider the accused's failure to get help in coming to your decision. The accused is found guilty, and at the CCA relied on specifically that fact, the fact that that the appellant did not seek help in time.
Okay, and this case is like that?
This case is not like that.
It's not like that.
There's no such instruction. There's no instruction removing.
There's no members. It's a military judge, right? It's before
yes, sir.
The military mm-hmm. judge alone?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. It's a military judge who's presumed to know and follow the law. The other point on this, Your Honor, is that the CCA wrote an opinion about hearsay. And in doing so, they wrote a background section for the reader to understand the issue of hearsay. The CCA did not write an opinion about factual sufficiency. For example, United States versus Riley, the opinion was about factual sufficiency. So
I don't think anyone would disagree that this misstatement or mischaracterization of what he was convicted of as opposed to what was offered by the government as uncharged misconduct was not critical to their opinion, but it nonetheless does make it appear as though their factual sufficiency review was flawed.
It's some evidence of that, but of course the CCA, the judges, like the military judge, presumed to know and follow the law. So with the appellant having the burden of showing that they erred in some way, he cannot do so because what they wrote an opinion about was an opinion about hearsay, not an opinion about factual sufficiency. Turning then to the admission of the appellant's sworn statement, as I said earlier, the issue was waived. The president, under Article 36, has the ability to make court-martial procedures, and in 304, determine that this is an issue that's waived if not raised before arraignment. When the president says waiver, but he means forfeiture, in the sense, that confusing sense that United States versus Gladue made clear, he says something about plain error review. So an example is RCM 920F, where the president has written that the issue is waived absent plain error. You compare that with 304, in this case, the president has said the issue is waived. It is waived and it may not be raised later unless the military judge allows that for good cause shown. So in this case, it's not a confusion between forfeiture and waiver. The issue is waived.
So you're relying on 304F1?
Your Honor, for the version, use at trial would have been D2A. Even if not, the appellant hasn't shown that the admission of the sworn statement was plain and obvious or that he suffered material prejudice. The Adams framework requires lining up on the one hand the essential facts of the admission and on the other hand independent corroborating evidence. And that independent corroborating evidence needs to only be slight. So in this case, for each offense, there are four essential facts in the confession that are important in this case. Those are the time, the place, the victim, which is to say the persons involved, and the method of the offense. So taking the Adams approach in this case, for the first offense, putting together, it's easier to put together the method and the victim. The appellant said in his sworn statement, I touched my daughter's vagina. The victim testified that appellant touched her vagina. The appellant in his sworn statement said it happened in Hawaii. The victim testified that it happened in Hawaii. Appellant's sworn statement said it happened in 2003. The victim testified that it happened in 2003. So there's independent evidence for each of those essential facts, and the same analysis applies for the second offense that happened in Texas in 2007. There are some essential facts that are not corroborated in this sworn statement, but those are facts that were helpful to the defense.
Where is the testimony that she testified as to specification one, that it happened in Hawaii in the bedroom, laying down next to her mother?
There's testimony. It's the sexual assault in the van, Your Honor.
Oh, so she testified that it happened in the van, and he testified that it happened in bed.
Correct, Your Honor. And the Adams framework requires lining up essential facts as compared to non-essential facts. So whether it was in a van or whether it was in a house was not essential to that sworn statement.
It's two different places?
You just said that there are four essential things: time, place, victim, and method.
Yes, Your Honor. And place, in this case, that need not be so certain or as certain as the appellant suggests. The place in this instance was Schofield Barracks, Hawaii, or at or near Schofield Barracks, Hawaii.
Do you have a view, counsel, as to what difference, if any, it makes that some of this uncharged misconduct was offered as propensity evidence? By which I mean, does propensity have any bearing on whether or not the confession is corroborated or not?
It does, Your Honor. It supports the fact that the offense happened, or the method of the offense. So that he has a propensity to touch his daughter in the vagina is evidence that he, in fact, did so. It's under the very slight burden required under Adams in 304. It helps to show that essential fact, at least, that the method of the offense was that he touched his daughter's vagina. And the remedy, the Adams remedy, is to excise certain facts out of the sworn statement. So doing so in this case, a couple examples of essential facts that may not have been corroborated were that appellant had a dream, or that appellant mistook the daughter for his wife. So had the military judge done what Adams requires, which is to excise essential facts that were not corroborated out of the sworn statement, what would have ended up happening is a sworn statement that was much more damaging to the accused, because the accused relied on parts of the sworn statement for his defense, his mistake defense, his dream defense.
Well, wait a minute. If you excise what's at variance, then it's what you end up is with, he touched her sometime in Hawaii.
Yes, Your Honor. He touched her in 2003 in Hawaii.
Okay. He touched her sometime in 2003 in Hawaii.
Yes, Your Honor. And so those essential facts would be admitted, would not be excised. And the other essential facts, for instance, with the specific location, more specific than Hawaii, could be excised if that's what the defense wanted.
Go ahead.
So what would have resulted is a sworn statement far more damaging than the one that was admitted. And so that's why...
I'd say it's a sworn statement that's so vague, it doesn't prove anything.
It would... Certainly the weight of the sworn statement would be up to the fact finder to determine. Yes, Your Honor. Be up to the fact finder to determine what weight to give that sworn statement. But appellant's complaint in this court is that it should not have been admitted at all, that the sworn statement wholesale should have been excluded, when there are essential facts that were corroborated in this case, others that perhaps shouldn't have been admitted because they weren't corroborated, but ones that were favorable to the defense. So on a plain error review, even if there is a plain error review in this case, the appellant can't show material prejudice to his substantial rights.
Isn't it true that some of the problem here is that the military judge didn't make a ruling on the uncharged acts? And so not having made a ruling and the defense not objecting, that means all the acts are in, are considered? Is that how you see it?
Yes, Your Honor. And at that point, the military judge is not bound by the trial counsel's closing argument. All of this evidence is in for him. He may think the trial counsel's closing argument is weak, and their theory is unsupported. but that the evidence is still shows guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
Didn't the military judge say that he would get to the motion during the trial at some point? They would address it later, and then it was never addressed.
He did. At one point, Your Honor, the defense counsel said, we'd like to take that up at the end and decide whether we want to log that objection at all. That's when the military judge stopped the proceedings to ask whether it was charged or uncharged misconduct. And the defense counsel essentially said, waived any objection or withdrew any standing objection to any of the evidence, and then never later logged that objection. They asked for the ability to decide whether they wanted to log it later, and then never did. So to that extent, all of that evidence was admitted. It was admitted without objection. So the military judge was entitled to rely on it and may have done so. Turning then to the legal sufficiency of the evidence, the admission was admitted into evidence. So it's part of this court's legal sufficiency review. So it's a thing that this court can rely on, a piece of evidence this court can rely on in conducting its legal sufficiency review. In doing so, it gives the evidence all of the weight, it sees it in the view most favorable to the prosecution, and so the evidence is legally sufficient. The appellant admitted to it. There's other evidence, of course, too, the victim's testimony, the victim's hearsay statements that were admitted. But the even if this court believes that there was a legal error in the admission of the sworn statement, the next step is to go to harmless error review, not to go to legal sufficiency review. Pending any further questions from the court, this court should affirm the CCA.
Thank you, counsel. Do we have rebuttal?
So why didn't you raise IAC?
Your Honor, to the extent that this court believes that the counsel were ineffective for not failing to raise a bill of particulars, certainly if this court wants to specify the issue and take it out of the Gros de Fond Matters Act, paragraph 7, they certainly can, and we'd be more than happy to supplement the court with briefs on that particular issue. 2 points, Your Honor. First, with respect to the 404B issue, and the evidence being in at trial, just because it's in at trial doesn't mean that it's evidence of the crimes itself. It means that the evidence may be there for potential other crimes that existed. Doesn't mean that the evidence itself is evidence of the crimes. Secondly, Your Honor, we believe that this court can still reach a decision with respect to both the corroboration issue as well as the legal sufficiency issue, without sending it back to the CCA. If this court does that, we certainly believe that the court should send it at the very least back to the CCA. Subject to the court's questions, appellant respectfully requests that this court set aside the findings and dismiss the charges and its specifications.
Okay. The court thanks counsel for both parties. The case is submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10:15.
Court stands in recess until 10:15.